As you know, Keith is teaching this quarter on 1 Corinthians, and he taught on chapter 8 on Wednesday night. So I'm scheduled to teach chapter 9, chapter 10, and the first half of chapter 11 while he's gone. He'll be gone today and Wednesday and the next Sunday, and then they'll be back. So we'll pick up on chapter 9, but first I want to say something about the three chapters. So if you have your Bible open to 1 Corinthians chapter 8, you'll note on the lesson title, he's got those three chapters together, which I think is correct, as eating meat offered to idols. So if you look at chapter 8 and verse 1, concerning things offered to idols. Remember, he's answering a letter they wrote beginning in chapter 7. And you have this kind of introductory phrase throughout the rest of the book concerning this or that. So they wrote him about things offered, like meat that had been offered to an idol. Can we eat it? That's the question. So he deals with that. Look in verse 10. If someone sees you who have knowledge sitting in an idol's temple. So again, you see, still dealing with the idea of eating the meat and where you eat it and the possible consequences of that, which you'll develop further, as we'll see in chapter 10. Now, go over to chapter 10. So you read chapter 9, you think, well, he's left that topic. No, he hasn't. When you get over to chapter 10 and verse 7, he gives some illustrations from the Old Testament of God's reproof of the nation of Israel. And you'll note in verse 7, do not be idolaters as some of them were. So these examples are particularly applied to the danger of falling into the trap of being involved in idolatry. And so that's exactly what he was talking about, meat offered to idols, which the idol worshiper did to honor their idol. He said, don't fall into that trap. Even if you think you can eat the meat under certain circumstances, be careful lest you fall into that trap and be practicing idolatry. Note verse 14. Therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry. So there's the application of these examples that he gave from the Old Testament. Flee from idolatry because God will judge those who practice idolatry. Then if you look down in verse 20 of chapter 10, he said the things with the Gentile sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons. So here again, a demon is an idol god of some sort, a demon. And so again, you see dealing with the fact that Gentiles, when they meet at their temple, or their, wherever their worship place is, they are sacrificing to that demon, expressing praise, petitioning that demon for his involvement in their lives, etc. You see, he's still talking about idolatry. If you look down in verse 28, if anyone says to you, this meat has been sacrificed to idols, do not eat it. When we get to chapter 10, you'll see that he's telling them that if you go to the marketplace and there's some meat, you don't have to ask if it's been offered to idols. You can invite somebody invite you into their home and they give you some meat. Go ahead and eat it. Unless they make a statement like this, which points to the fact that there's still some connection to idolatry. In that case, he said, don't eat it. Because it has a significance when you eat it under those circumstances. Now, look at verse 31, and I'm going to come back to that one, because this is the bottom line. This is the basic principle of all three of these chapters. He said, whatever then you do, whether you eat or drink, whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. Everything in chapter 8, 9, and 10 falls under that umbrella of that basic principle. In fact, the entire Bible, everything that men are told to do, this is a great verse to remember. You got to make a decision about something and you're not sure about it. Here's the question. Will it glorify God? That's what he said, whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. All right, so that's the first. That's the three chapters, and you see that thread running through them. Now, in chapter 8, let's go back to chapter 8. And what you want to note here as you look in chapter 8 is that the fact that, look down in verse 10, if someone sees you, who have knowledge, dining in an idol's temple, will not his conscience, if he is weak, be strengthened? Actually, he points out later, it's going to be ruined. the figure of speech. You ruin his conscience, because what the conscience does is say to you, that's wrong, don't do it. And so this would be the way the Gnostic would argue. We're going to strengthen his conscience. No, his conscience says don't do it, but he sees you doing it, so he'll do it. But he's doing it with consciousness of an idol. And so he says, to eat things sacrificed to idols, and through your knowledge, who he is weak is ruined or destroyed or perish, the brother for whose sake Christ died. So there may be liberties you can have as to the eating of the meat, but here's the thing that he appeals to here and in chapter 10, and he's going to illustrate with himself in chapter 9, that even though God has given us the right to do things, one of the principles, and very important principle, is how does it impact others? We live in a society where we say, I don't care what others do. It's not in my affairs. Yes, it is, especially if they're brethren in the Lord. How I dress, how I talk, where I go, what I use for entertainment, whatever it may be, how does it impact others? And so here you see that very thing. Here's something that's right in and of itself, to eat the meat that had been offered to an idol, but now you just have it somewhere, you bought it at the grocery market, or somebody invited you over to eat, it's okay. But be careful. He said, look down in verse 12, by sinning against the brethren and wounding their conscience when it's weak, you sin against Christ. If food causes my brother to stumble. We talk about a stumbling block. It's not just, I don't like you doing that. It's the idea you cause someone to violate their conscience because they see you doing it and think, well, if he does it, it must be okay. But their conscience really is still having problems with it. You don't want to put that person in that circumstance. So he starts dealing with that in chapter 8, and we'll see as we look at chapter 9, he uses himself as an illustration of that. But I want you to note, look at chapter 8 and verse 9. Here's a word I want you to see, a word thread that runs through this 8 and 9, and then in 10, maybe not that word, but that idea. He said, take care lest this liberty of yours. Now, your version may read something different, but it's the idea of the right to do something. In fact, if you have the New American Standard Version, you have a footnote. It says literally right. It's a word used in the New Testament for authority, which is the right either to rule or to act. That's what that word means, that particular word that he used. And so if you have the right to act, the liberty to do it, be careful lest this liberty of yours does not become a stumbling block. You call someone whose conscience is not as strong as it ought to be. If their conscience is strong, it doesn't make any difference what you do. Their conscience will say, don't do it. And it'll convict them and keep them from doing it. That's the function of the conscience. But their conscience is weak. It's not that strong. And you'll cause them to violate it. So, but you see here, it's a liberty, a right, that you may need to forfeit under circumstances. So, it's easy for Paul to write the letter, but what about himself? So that's chapter 9. And he uses himself as an illustration and deals in dealing with this illustration some of the problems that were under the Corinthian situation. Hold your finger at chapter 9 and go to 2 Corinthians chapter 11. 2 Corinthians chapter 11, if you will. And look at verse 7. 2 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 7. He said, did I commit a sin in humbling myself so that you might be exalted because I preached the gospel of God to you without charge? You're going to see him arguing the right. We'll see that in just a moment when we look at chapter 9 in 1 Corinthians. The right to be supported by Corinth because he was working there and preaching the gospel. But he said, I was willing to forego that right, to give up that right. I did not take any wages from you for my work there. Did I sin? When you get to chapter 10 of 2 Corinthians through 13, there's a lot of sarcastic irony. And irony is when you say one thing and mean the opposite. He didn't sin, but they're trying to use that against him. And you'll see as we read further, in their thinking, in their society, if a teacher didn't accept support, that meant he knew he wasn't worthy of support. Paul said, that's not the case at all. I didn't take it, as we'll see, because of the circumstances in Corinth. He deals with that in the second Corinthian letter, but alludes to it in the First Corinthians letter, chapter 9. So you see that in verse 7. Look at 8. I robbed other churches. Rob? Did he rob anybody? He didn't rob anybody. Here again is irony. I should have been getting wages from you, but I'm taking it from other churches. Lawful, but he used this figure of speech to point out this is not the way it should have worked if everything would have been the way it should have been in Corinth. I robbed other churches, taking wages of them, he said, to serve you. And then he goes on to talk about how while he was with them, he would not receive those wages. Now, verse 10, as the truth of Christ is in me, this boasting of mine, boasting, was Paul a boastful fellow? Remember, he's under attack, and that's very important when you read 2 Corinthians, especially the 10 through 13. So, this boasting of mine will not be stopped in the regions of Achaia. And so, verse 12, he said, the reason I did that, I may cut off opportunity of those who desire an opportunity to be regarded just as we are in the matter about which they are boasting. So they were there to be glad to receive your support. Paul won't take it. Well, he knows he's not worthy. He said, that's not the case at all. Well, why in the world, if he had the right to be supported by Corinth, would he give it up? So he uses that here in 1 Corinthians chapter 9. Go back to chapter 9, 1 Corinthians. Now, we started with that word back up in verse 9, liberty or right. Now, look at verse 4. Well, let me start out in verse 1. Am I not free? Am I not an apostle? Have I not seen Jesus Christ our Lord? Are you not my work in the Lord? If to others I'm not an apostle, at least I am to you, for you are the seal of my apostleship in the Lord. How were they the seal of his apostleship? Because he said he was one? What did Paul do when he went to a city and began to preach the gospel? He worked miracles. He talked about that in 1 Corinthians 2:5, the demonstration of the Spirit and of power. He had the power in the first century to work miracles to prove that his message was heaven's message. And he says, you folks of all people ought to know that I am an apostle of Jesus Christ. So then he says, verse 3, my defense to those who examine me is this. Well, wait, if you're an apostle, you should have wanted support. Why didn't you take our support? Is that not an admission of your unworthiness? No, that's not it at all. Now he argues his right to support. No. Do we have a right to eat and drink? Now, is Paul asking, do I have a right to eat and drink, or have I got to starve myself to death? Obviously not. There's a connected thought with it. Have we not the right to eat and drink and be supported to eat and drink? That's the whole question, the right of support. Do we not have a right for whoever we serve, the churches we serve, to provide the needs of life? Eating and drinking put for the needs of life. Just like Jesus said, pray for your bread. Give us this day our daily bread. He's not talking about a loaf of bread. He's talking about food to sustain life. So have we not the right to eat and drink and churches, expect churches to provide the needs that we have? So then he says, do we not have a right to take along a believing wife to get married? So again, it's not the question of whether you had a right to get married. The question is, do we have a right to have a wife, travel with a wife, and expect the church to provide for those expenses? We find when Paul traveled, churches did help him with his expenses. And we do that when we have men in for gospel meetings. And so here he's asking that very question. And so then verse 6, or do only Barnabas and I not have a right? Now here's the word right. See, three times, now you're getting down to it, to refrain from working. Now, people make jokes about preachers don't work. See, I've got a Bible verse that says I don't have to work right here. Don't have a right to refrain from working. The idea is for support, to have a secular job, to provide eating and drinking, provide for my wife, my family, etc. Do we not have a right to be supported so we don't have to be involved in that? We'll see more about that in the verses on the lesson here in a minute. So, then, to argue his right, he uses some illustrations. We have this on your lesson. And on the lesson 8, we've already covered these chapters 8 through 10 all around. That's one subject of idolatry. And then the application he's making is to the right to eat meat offered to idols and how that impacts others. So, now we get here We got this dialogue in chapter 8 that we looked at. I'm not going to go back over that Keith did. But go over to your chapter 9 lesson that you should have. And I've got those verses down that we've been talking about the word right. And in chapter 9, verse 18, you have it again. The use of my right in the gospel. You see that there. And then when you get to chapter 10, if you look in chapter 10 and verse 29, he doesn't use the word right, but it's a companion idea. I mean not your own conscience, but the other man's, for why is my freedom judged by another's conscience? Freedom to what? To eat the meat. My right to eat the meat, in other words. So you see that application from main idea is idolatry, but then here's the idea of this liberty I have and how it impacts others. That runs through these three chapters. So, now he's arguing his right to be supported here in chapter 9 because he's going to make a point relative to this whole concept of the things I have a right to do that I will forego, even though it creates a difficulty for me because I don't want it to in any way impinge on anybody's salvation. You notice at the end of chapter 8, he made this remarkable statement. See that last verse in chapter 8? He said, if food causes my brother to stumble, I'll never eat meat again. So I don't want to cause my brother to stumble. That is, to lose his soul. I won't do anything, even though I have a right to do it, if it's going to cause my brother to lose his soul. That's the idea. And so he's illustrating his own, that he not just wrote that, but he practiced that in his life. So he argues his right, and he said, verse 7, here's the arguments he made, and we have that on the lesson. He uses analogies based on human judgment, first of all. So he's not quoting a verse, he's just appealing to what they know in life. First, he appeals to what? A soldier. Who at any time serves as a soldier's own expense. So even the Roman army, not only the expense of living, but their weapons, their armor, all of that was provided. And we understand that in the military today because their life is devoted to that particular work for the good of the people, and so they are provided. And folks, he said, you understand that. And so then he says, who plants a vineyard does not eat the fruit of it? So he talked about a farmer. The third illustration from, again, he's not quoting verses, he's just using common sense. He said, if a fellow tends a flock, does he not eat the drink from the milk of the flock? Doesn't he benefit from the work that he's doing to provide for his family? Certainly. Well, those are three analogies that he makes. But then you'll see part 3b on your lesson, analogies based on the law. Now he turns to the law of Moses. And so look, he said in verse 9, it is written in the law of Moses, you shall not muzzle the ox while he's threshing. Now if you ever want to call a preacher an ox, here's one, see? He's using an ox as an illustration. But the point is, he says, you don't muzzle the ox. He said, God's not concerned about oxen, is he? And the point is that whoever, if you plow, he said, verse 10, you plow in hope. The thresher threshes in hope. And so the idea, if you're working, you should expect to be fed, to be provided for. That ox should have an owner that will provide for his needs, give him safety in time of storm or whatever it may be, because he's working for them. And even the Old Testament alluded to that very idea, and he uses this illustration. So he appeals to the ox. But then, when you get down, and let's start in 11, if we sow spiritual things to you, is it too much if we reap material things from you? If others share the right over you, others who? People in the church there, these false workers, they were glad to accept the money, but they were false. He said, but if you think they have the right, shouldn't we have the right? Nevertheless, we did not use this. Now, here's our word. We had the right, but we did not use it. But, you say, well, doesn't that cause hardship? Yes, but we endure. We endure all things. Why, Paul? Same point he brought up in chapter 8. That we cause no hindrance to the gospel of Christ. That's the overriding concern. How will this affect the gospel? Jesus came to save souls. I don't want to do anything to divert that to his purpose in coming. Do you not know that those who perform sacred services eat the food of the temple? Those who attend regularly to the altar have their share from the altar. So he appeals to the priesthood and the Levitical system. So in the law, God made provision for the Levites. The other Israelites were given land where they could have flocks and herds. But the Levites did not get that same land apportionment. They would get land sometime around a city. But how are they going to feed their families? They would be fed by the offerings the people gave. So let's divert for just a moment. I've got some verses here. We're not going to have time to read all of those, but I just want to call your attention to some of these verses. Look at Numbers chapter 18 real quick. Turn over to Numbers 18. This is very instructive. So this comparison, by the way, is a good passage to study when you talk about preacher support. We don't have time to get into that. But you will see this as you look at Numbers 18, verse 8. The Lord spoke to Aaron, "Now behold, I myself have given you charge of my offering, even all the holy gifts of the sons of Israel. I have given them to you as a portion and to your sons as a perpetual allotment." So Aaron and his sons, the priests, would get fed from the offerings. Now note what he says, verse 9, at the end of verse 9. Who do they give these offerings to? Do they give them to the priests? No. They render them to me. And he said, "I'm giving them to you." He said, "This is for the Lord." What's that preacher getting? What's that priest getting? He's serving me, and he's serving you people, and I'm giving the offering you give to me for his support. They render them to me. Note again, down in verse 12. And by the way, it's all the best of the oil, the best of the fresh wine, grain, the first fruits, which they give to the Lord, I give them to you. Verse 13, which they bring to the Lord shall be yours. So sometimes when men in meetings get together and talk about preacher support, say, remember, this is the Lord's money. We've got to be sure how we use it right. Well, yeah, it is the Lord's money. How does he want it used? Read it. That's how he wants it used. And if you were to compute the number of Levites at this time, book of Numbers, there were census taken, the number of Levites compared to the nation of Israel, and they were to receive the tithes, you'll see that the plan, and I've mentioned this time and time again in various places, no one has ever been able to contradict it. God provided on an annual basis that they would actually be supported anywhere from like 2 to 2.5 times the annual salary of the Israelites. Remember, they didn't have crops. They didn't have a land. They didn't have herds. So God wanted these men provided for. And you see that in Numbers 18. And Paul is appealing to that. It's his right to preach the gospel. He appeals to that very practice. Look at Leviticus chapter... Well, I'm going to skip that for sake of time. That's where those who offered the sacrifice got the hide, the skin of the burnt offering. Imagine how many hides you would have and what you could do with that. Sell them, whatever, use them for clothing. All this nation of over 600,000 men, 20 years old and upward, book of Numbers, they're bringing offerings, peace offerings, sin offerings, thank offerings. You get the hide if it's a burnt offering and the animal's killed. That's Leviticus 7 and 8. Look at 2 Chronicles chapter 31. This is instructive. Look at 2 Chronicles chapter 31. And look at verse 4. He said, he commanded the people, for David commanded the people who lived in Jerusalem to give the portion due to the priest and Levite, that's Numbers 18, we just read about it, in that verse over in Leviticus 7, to give their portion. Why? Here it is, that they may devote themselves to the law of the Lord. They don't need to be out there chasing sheep and taking care of pastures. They need to be spending time studying. They were teachers. They need to know the Word of God. They need to prepare themselves for sacrifices and give attention to it. Well, I'm not going to read Nehemiah 13:10-14, but that's a great reading. What was happening, that was being neglected. And Nehemiah was angry. And as a result, you know what the Levites and priests were doing? They were going to their fields. We've got to support our family. Nehemiah said, we've got to straighten this out. You better bring this support in here, these offerings, so these men can be supported and devote themselves to the work. Look over at Malachi chapter 1, last book in your Old Testament. Malachi chapter 1. Malachi chapter 1, verse 6, he's accusing the prophet, God through the prophet, is accusing the people of not giving him the honor due his name. You'll see that at the end of verse 6. You say, have we despised your name? Verse 7, you're saying, have we defiled you? And he talks about the fact that these priests now, people would bring an offering. And they'd bring an old lamb, maybe that was lame or blind. And the priest would accept it. He says, shame on you. I deserve better. Don't accept that kind of sacrifice. You're the priest, and you ought to be teaching the people. And you should not be accepting those kind of offerings. But they had gotten lackadaisical about their work, and he reproved these priests severely here in the book of Malachi. Now look at the last verse. Cursed be the swindler who has a male in his flock and vows, your sacrifice is a blemished animal to the Lord. So don't ever say, I give all I can give. None of us give all we can give. You consider the God you want to serve, and you give what you deem as a sacrifice of praise and thanksgiving because of the God that you love and what he's done for you. Not just, oh, it's a Sunday, I got to put some money into play. Not that kind of thing. Look, he says, he sacrificed a blemished animal, but he says, I am a great king, and my name is feared among the nations. You need to make your offerings in view of who I am. I am worthy of your sacrifice and these offerings that I've set up. Chapter 3, he talks about it again. He said, verse 8, will a man rob God? They asked the question. They said, have we robbed you? Verse 8, have we robbed you? Look at it in tithes and offerings. Oh, we robbed the priest and leave it. No, God said, you robbed me. Remember we read in Numbers? You give this to me, and I'm giving it to the Levite. And so when we are here in 1 Corinthians 9, go back to 1 Corinthians 9. He's using that here in these verses to argue his right, first of all, by analogies from their everyday experience, the soldier, the farmer, the shepherd, and then this appeal to the law and how God provided for the support of the priest. Did you have a comment?
Yes, Steve. I want to reemphasize a point that you just made. Sometimes today in churches, brethren feel that a preacher should only be supported to meet the basic needs, no more. Sometimes brethren feel kind of bad that you're giving the money that you give to your preacher. Well, if you look at the example of the Levites, they were abundantly supplied. They were, who would God call them rich? And so that's something for us to consider when we consider supporting gospel preachers.
And that was God's plan. Good point that Rocky makes, that the Levitical priesthood was, by God's design, was well supported so that they could give their time to the things they needed to do. And their work was so important. And the offerings, the sacrifice, and teaching the nation. Malachi talks about that failure of them to teach, by the way. Throughout the prophets, Jeremiah and others, he reproves them for their failure to be the teachers they ought to be. And so that was their work. All right, good comment, Rocky. All right, so let's continue here in chapter 9. Verse 14, so the Lord directed. The Lord directed. Where? In these Old Testament passages, set the example of those devoted to his work were to be supported. Those who proclaim the gospel to get their living from the gospel. But he said, I've used none of these things. Why? Didn't he need? Yes, he needed. Yeah, he worked day and night to support those with him. He says that in 2 Thessalonians chapter, I believe it's 3. Maybe another chapter. But he worked to support himself. And he said, I'm not writing that this be done in my case. I can see why he wrote that. I was teaching a series on worship here many, many years ago. And so we talked about the Lord's Supper and prayer and et cetera, and got down to the point about giving. And I made the point. I said, now I'm going to teach what the Bible says about giving and supporting preachers, et cetera. But I don't need a raise. I'm not asking for one. One of the men went to one of the elders and said, why don't you give him a raise? And so he shut up about that. Fortunately, he had a good elder. He said, he's going to preach on it again next week. And he didn't bend a bit. But that's what happened. That's what Paul's dealing with right here. He said, I'm not writing this so you start supporting me. That's not my point. I'm trying to teach why I'm willing to give up this right to cause the gospel to spread, not to be a hindrance to the gospel, which is what I'm encouraging you to do in chapter 8 and what he's encouraging you to do in chapter 10. So he points in verse 16, if I preach the gospel, I have nothing to boast of, for I'm under compulsion. Of course, God had chosen him, said you're going to be a minister to the Gentiles and preach the gospel, and that's exactly what he did. He said, woe is to me if I do not preach the gospel. But if I do this voluntarily, I have a reward. But if against my will, I have a stewardship. Trust him. And say, I don't want to do that, Lord, but I'm going to do it because you told me I ought to do it. Because Paul wanted to preach. But the point was, I have a stewardship, and he did as an apostle of Jesus Christ. So, what then is my reward? If I'm not getting any support, what's my reward? That when I preach the gospel, I may offer the gospel without charge so as not to make full use of my what? Right. There's our word. My right, I have full use to be supported. I've chosen in your case, and that was really pointing to a failure in the Corinthian church, attitudes that were a problem there, not to use my right in the gospel. Though I am free, note that free, remember I pointed out in 1 Corinthians 10, he uses the word freedom. I am free from all men. I have made myself a slave to all. Why? Why would you do that? So I may win more. I'm willing to give up some liberties to win people. And that can impact us, not about eating meat offered to idols, but our entertainment, how we dress, what we do. How's it going to impact others? Is it going to build them up or tear them down? So then he said, to the Jews I became a Jew, so I might win the Jews. To those under the law is under the law, though not myself being under the law. So I might win those who are under the law. Those who are without law is without law. It didn't mean he abandoned God's law. He's talking about Gentiles, not under the law of Moses. And he said, I became as without law, not being without the law of God, but under the law of Christ, so I might win those who are without law. So among Gentiles, he would try to incorporate their practices, but among Jews, theirs. His aim was to please God, number one, and to win people for God. And that's what you have him illustrating, that he practiced the very thing that he was teaching them in this letter. So, note verse 23. Here it is. What's verse 9, chapter 9 about? Here it is. I do all things for the sake of the gospel. That's it. I do all things for the sake of the gospel, that I may become fellow partaker of it. And he's going to talk about that partaking of it, not only in the joy of people obeying the gospel, but in the hope that are awaiting. As you read verse 24 through 27. So, fellow wants to be he sees one of these races on TV and sees these guys running, and man, they run good and they run fast, and at the end there's an award maybe, and they get money and they get offers for ads, and they get rich and they get famous. And she goes, boy, I want to be a runner. I'd like to run anyway. It'd be nice to win that prize or stand on stand on the place where they give that award and be honored. Now, look here. You say, okay, that's good. Did you know what you're going to have to do? To get that in that race that's going to happen next year in June, in the summer, you're going to have to start running today and tomorrow and the next day and the next day. But Thanksgiving is coming. You're going to have to run. You're going to have to watch your diet. But Christmas is coming. You're going to have to run and run and run. If you want to be ready to win that race, you're going to have to be willing to sacrifice for it. And he uses that illustration. Look at that. Do you not know those who run into all run, but only one receives the prize? Run in such a way. That's what this is about. It's not just about running. It's not just about being a Christian. But suppose there's only one that gets the prize. Do you want to be the one? Run that way. Live your life as a Christian that way. So I'm going to be, people say, I'm a Christian, I got baptized, and they're out here on the margin, just as long as I kind of keep one foot in the door. No. Run so you get the prize. So you will be like the winner in the contest. Now that's just an analogy. He's not going to say there's just one that's going to get the reward. But run that way, with that purpose, and with that dedication, with that resolve. Be willing to make the sacrifices necessary to gain that end. He said, So, interesting, isn't it? Here we are 2,000 years removed from these letters. He's using sports analogies. We've got some young men here today, and young women, and so we think of sports and football and lacrosse and soccer. He's using their sports as analogies, people that understand that. And what the first one he uses, you can see, is the idea of race. Now, verse 25, everyone who competes in the games does what? I can't have any Krispy Kreme donuts. He exercises self-control. Man, I don't like to get up early, but I gotta get up and run. Or he's going to illustrate with a boxer in a moment. I got to get up and I got to go to the gym, man. If I'm going to win that boxing match, I'd rather sleep in, but I got to get up and go exercise. And I've got to watch what I eat. What I do. Is it worth it? That's his point. Is it worth it? And so he says, everyone who competes in the games, and these games, the games there in Greece, of course, that's where we get our Olympic background of our Olympics. This was a serious matter for these people. And so, in fact, our word gymnastic or gymnast comes from the word naked. And they would actually exercise naked. I mean, they were intent on winning the prize. And so he says, those who compete in the games exercise self-control in all things. They do it to receive a perishable wreath. Oh, here's this beautiful wreath. What's it going to be a week from now? Well, it's kind of wilted. Even if it's metal, is it going to stay its beauty and its shine? It's perishable. But boy, I want it. He says, look, we and imperishable. You want a reward that will last past death into eternity. Past death. It'll never tarnish. It'll never wilt. When God promises a reward, He makes good on the promise. And He said, you work for that end, He said, is how much are you willing to sacrifice for that? What are you willing to give up? Well, I like to play games on the iPad. I like to go places and do things. How much are you willing to give up? Lord willing, maybe this morning I'm going to preach on the growth of a child of God. You want to grow? Get this attitude right here. You won't grow accidentally. You might grow a little bit by going to church now and then. But you really want to grow, and you really want to be a service, have this attitude. Here it is right here. Got another point in on the sermon about that. So, anyway, it's a great text. Now look at what he says. Therefore, I run in such a way as not without aim. Do you have any purpose? And you say, yeah, I got a purpose. I got to go to work, man. I set my clock, got my clothes ready. Is there some other purpose in life that would cause you to set your clock and do things like growing in Christ, being a Christian, serving in the gospel? Don't run without aim. Well, I got baptized. I got my ticket on the bus. I got on the right bus. I'm going to heaven. No, don't run without aim. Have a purpose in what you're doing. Look, he said, I box in such a way as not beating the air. Not just beating the air. I intend to win. And so I don't know what kind of exercise equipment they had back then. But he said, this is not just exercising my arms. I intend to win this boxing match. And he said, but I discipline my body and make it my slave so that after I have preached to others, and isn't he preaching to others? Yes. Chapter 8, chapter 10. Of course, Wally was there. But he said, I could be disqualified. I don't practice what I'm telling you. He said, I'm practicing it. I'm not just telling you to do this. That's why I'm not receiving support. Now, I'm not dealing here with the issue enlarged on in 2 Corinthians 11, but that's there. These guys who were using his lack of support trying to undermine him. He said, no, I'm doing it because I love you, because of my dedication to the gospel of Christ. Okay, our time is about up. Any comments or questions?